I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that has been controversial from the very founding of the Republic, and it continues into this day, and I suspect it's going to continue in the coming decades, and that is the question of the war powers of the president and their appropriate use. Our episode today is entitled Clear and Present Danger, the Use and Abuse of the War Powers by U.S. Presidents. And I'm joined for a conversation today by Professor Sarah Burns. She is an old friend of the Ashbrook Center. Well, not old. She's pretty young, actually, but a near and dear friend of the Ashbrook Center. Sarah is Associate Professor of Political Science at the Rochester Institute of Technology, a great place that has a wonderful department. She received her BA from the University of Toronto, my alma mater for grad school, and then her MA and PhD from Claremont Graduate University. She has taught a number of courses, both at her current institution and in our Teaching American History program and Master of Arts, on the U.S. presidency, on the American Constitution, and on the intersection between those two. And in addition to being a terrific teacher and a wonderful colleague, she's also a great scholar. She has a really first-rate book, I think put out in 2019, so relatively recently, called The Politics of War Powers, The Theory and History of Presidential Unilateralism. It is a terrific book. I would highly recommend it to those of you who are listening who want to dig deeper into the topic that we're going to be talking about today, because it is a topic that's always in the news. It's always an issue whenever the United States is involved in any kind of military action around the world. People raise the question, how much power does and should the president have? And just to complete it, she is actually working on a book, finished it, and now looking to publish her next book, which is called Losing the Peace: U.S. Foreign Policy and Democratization. It's going to be a terrific book when it comes out. Let me encourage all of our listeners to buy it. Sarah, thanks for joining us on The American Idea.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
In your book, which I've looked at, I think it's terrific, you have raised an interesting criticism, which is you argue that there is a great danger in unilateral war action by the American president. And you criticize, interestingly enough, both Congress and presidents for, in a way, failing to live up to what you regard as our constitutional, founding constitutional principles with respect to the war power. Take us back to the American founding to start this conversation. Because look, it's a conversation that we hear critics of President Biden attacking him for this. We heard critics of President Trump. We hear critics of every modern president say the president is exercising too much power in matters of war, usurping the powers of Congress, being the United, making America the world's policeman. All of the criticisms that we've heard many times since the beginning of the Cold War. But take us back to the beginning, to the American founding. And I'm thinking in particular about even the debates in the Constitutional Convention, when our founders are thinking about what's going to be the war powers of the federal government and what role the president should have in those war powers.
Yeah, thank you so much. Great opening question. And that's obviously a great place to start. You're correct to say that I'm an equal opportunity blamer when it comes to Congress and the presidency. I don't think it would be fair to say that the president is the one who's trying to take the powers away from Congress, because if you look at what they were doing in the Constitutional Convention, in the Constitution itself, you can see that they were trying very clearly to make, as Madison says, ambition counteract ambition. And they were doing that by having, again, Madison saying the interest of the man being joined with the interest of the place. So the principle was that Congress was then going to stand up to presidents. And so there was always a sense with among the founders that presidents certainly would try and take powers that were not their own. Presidents would certainly sort of try, especially in the realm of war, to get more and more power for themselves. But Congress was always going to be there to be slow and deliberative and plotting and say, you know, do we really need to do this? Do we really need these wars? Or is this some sort of ambition on the part of the executive? And very clearly, we see that in the Constitution, they then say what's important is to say that at the initiation point, we need to have Congress be the ones who are deciding. And so what I say to students and what I think is a fairly plain reading of the constitutional text is when you say, okay, well, if Congress has the power to declare war, then it must be that they have some powers put into the hands of Congress at that initial phase. And then after that, yes, they make the president commander in chief. Yes, he is the one who's leading the military. However, they also make it so that the Congress has the power of the purse to say, here are these restrictions and restraints if we don't like how it is you're spending the money or how it is you're conducting this war. So that balance between the two political branches makes it so that there should be some kind of fight between them, right? Not actual fighting, but some kind of debate about what we should do, how we should do it, and when we should do it. And that worked extremely well. So we see this in the founding era. We see early on with the neutrality proclamation from the Washington administration that Hamilton and Madison disagreed. So we didn't have perfect agreement amongst the founders, even from the first administration. But all the same, you have a decent amount of, well, you know, the legislature should do certain things, the executive should do certain things, and they're going to battle between them for who has the power to control foreign policy and specifically war making. And that worked fairly well for a very long time. And it just started breaking down in the 20th century, really, arguably, maybe the late 19th century.
Well, tell us a little bit more about some of those early debates. For example, you mentioned the Neutrality Proclamation. Well, that's in 1793, I think, right? During the Washington Yes. administration. And there's a war between Britain and France, or between France and the rest of Europe, essentially. And the United States is kind of caught in the middle. And some people want us to join the French side. Some people want us to join the British side. And some people in America want us to stay neutral between them. Just take us back to that moment of controversy, because as you say, that's really one of the first flashpoints for the beginning of this conversation about, okay, we've got this Constitution. It says Congress has the power to declare war. It says the president is the commander in chief. Now in the real world, what does that actually mean? How do we see that play out in that controversy in 1793?
I think we see it play out in what I would claim is a very healthy constitutional battle. So we see Hamilton and the Washington administration collectively say we need a neutrality proclamation. And essentially they thought they needed that because they had a treaty of friendship with the French dating back to, and this gets a little confusing, but dating back to 1775, I believe it was, maybe 1778. I think it was already a republic, but this was under the monarchy. So it was a different regime. But it essentially said that because of this treaty of friendship, the U.S. would come to the French aid in the West Indies, in the Caribbean, and help them. Now, the Washington administration very correctly, I would say, knew that if the United States got pulled into a war on the French side against the British, the Republic would fall, right? They just didn't have the military. They didn't have the resources. They didn't have the capacity to mount a huge defense against the British. And the British, as I'm sure is understandable from a human perspective, were looking for the Americans to fail, looking for a reason to really disrupt the Republic, right? They didn't have very friendly feelings towards the Americans at the time. And so the Washington administration collectively decided, including Jefferson, who was in the administration at the time, that they just could not become part of this war. So Washington exercised what we generally think is a fair understanding of executive power, which is that he decided he could interpret the treaty, and he interpreted the treaty to allow the United States to not adhere to it, to not adhere to the friendship between the U.S. and the French. And so, you know, can we say that this is a fair interpretation of the treaty? I don't really think so. Is it a prudent interpretation of the treaty? Yes, it was a very prudent interpretation of the treaty. And I think started a long tradition that we see in the United States of having an ally in the French and then occasionally not being the friendliest and the best ally with the French. But in this situation, again, it was very, very prudent for the Washington administration, because as you mentioned, there were lots of people who were in favor of the French, but there were just as many people who were in favor of the British or siding with the British against the French, because in part the French seemed much more violent in their republicanism and much more inclined towards a militarism that the United States was very cautious about. And so while you see people like Thomas Jefferson, who were quite casual about the body count that might come with revolution, like the French revolutions, you also equally see people like a John Adams, who was saying, you know, we have to be very careful and circumspect with our partnerships and alliances, right? Obviously, Washington very famously said we should avoid really entangling alliances. So because of that split or sort of difference of opinion within the United States, the Washington administration said, as the government, we are going to declare neutrality, meaning that if it happened to be that you had citizens who were inclined to help either side for whatever reason, the government had plausible deniability to say, look, they were acting on their own. We didn't tell them they could do this. We, in fact, expressly told them not to do this. So that would make it possible for the U.S. to save face and to save face government to government.
So what about now, then? Can I just ask you this then? That seems to have worked, right? We stayed neutral. People mm-hmm. did criticize Washington, of course, but then you just say there was a debate in the press between Alexander Hamilton and James Madison over whether the president really has the constitutional power to do it. But certainly in that case, Hamilton and Washington made the argument, look, we're not trying to get us into war. We're trying to keep us out of war. Mm-hmm. But then I'm thinking about another early controversy in the Republic, the War of 1812, right? Now James Madison is not the father of the Constitution. He's actually the president. And there's a lot of people in Congress who say we should go to war with the British, the War of 1812, right? We should go to war with the British. Madison, and they implore Madison to sort of carry out warlike actions against the British. And as I remember, Madison sends a war message to Congress saying, look, if you want to declare war, fine. But as the president, I can't do that. Tell us a little bit about that moment.
Yeah, that's a really interesting moment in Madison's, constitutional development and his own sort of thinking around the Constitution and what the president can do within the American constitutional system. And he essentially felt that you should have a very, very conscribed power within the presidency. And so it can only act in the Madisonian understanding once the legislature act. So in certain senses, the executive is above the legislature insofar as he has interpretive power, he or she, if there's ever a woman. And that's the way that Washington interprets it. Madison, conversely, takes a very, very, like I said, constrained view of executive power and says, no, the president is only able to carry out the orders, essentially, the laws that are created by the legislative branch. And so that's in part why Madison sends it to the legislature and says, you guys are the ones who are in charge. I think also, again, in terms of his own understanding of the constitutional system, he wanted to work extremely hard to avoid what he thought was the natural pull of the executive, especially in the realm of war, right? Which is the aggrandizing of the office, the aggrandizing of all of the people within the office who could potentially make money or become, you know, more elevated because of their role in the war. And so all of that made him extremely cautious in the way that he exercised power. And as a consequence, we see him being much slower to act, to get into the war than he he could have been given the justifications that he faced, right? There was a lot of, there were years and years and years of the British really undermining the US and really acting in a way that was extremely aggressive towards the United States. And as a consequence, Thomas Jefferson, prior to Madison becoming president, was already trying to engage in like economic warfare with the British, but it wasn't working because their economy was just too big for the US to really impact it. And so Madison was essentially between a rock and a hard place, where he really needed to do something militarily, because that was the language that people really responded to at the time. And at the same time, because he felt so constrained by his understanding of his constitutional role, he did not want to act without legislative consent. The last part of this, I would say, is the rampant partisanship. And so you had Federalists who were against Madison, against Madison's party, who likely were inclined to say no to whatever Madison suggested, and also very friendly in their views towards the British, right? So this is echoes of similar problems that we have today with partisanship, but both more and less highbrow, let's say, in the way that they were acting.
Right. So when does, so this notion James Madison had of a president who has very limited war powers, that really can't initiate military action of any kind until Congress declares war. That's clearly a very powerful strand in American constitutional thinking and in the ideas of presidents through the 19th century. Although, of course, James Polk's war in Mexico, people like Abraham Lincoln claimed it was unconstitutional. Then people claim that what some of the things Lincoln did during the Civil War militarily were unconstitutional. But there certainly does remain that powerful strand in American thinking about the war powers of the president, at least into the, as you said, late 19th or maybe early 20th century. When do presidents start thinking differently and start thinking, I think I have more war power than what other people believe?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's perhaps not, unlike the progressive era, that you could say just there was something kind of in the water, let's say, where it's like everyone was sort of like imbued with different ideas and it was just sort of around in the water, in the air. With presidents, you have personalities that kind of pop up and say, you know, maybe we should have more power. Maybe the president should be more powerful than he was, especially in the realm of war. And Polk, as you mentioned, I think had an ambition for the United States that made him disinclined. I don't know why I'm being generous to Polk. I can just throw him under the bus. He was so ambitious, and he was so inclined to do exactly what it is the Constitution should stop him from doing, which is getting into a war of ambition. And so the reason that particular, the Mexican-American War, is very frustrating, this is 1846, is because the Constitution at the time was still very, very healthy and in principle should have stopped Polk from acting, because Congress should have said, you know, you're making these claims that the Mexicans shot Americans on American soil. Like, let's take some time to try and think about whether or not that happened. And Polk did what I call hurrying language, where he's like, no, we need a decision now. Like, we have to avenge these fallen soldiers. And there were enough people in Congress who kind of hurried things along so that those who were doing the congressional job of slowly thinking through the questions of war were not capable of fully doing their job and stopping the war from happening. So Polk is anomalous, let's say, in the 19th century in terms of that kind of thinking. I would argue the complicated thing, you know, we're never going to solve Lincoln in 5 minutes of conversation. But the complicated thing with Lincoln is he really was facing an emergency that required novel thinking about the Constitution, novel thinking about how he as an actor could act within the constitutional system in an effort to save it. And so both are then unique in the 19th century, and we see the Constitution snap back, let's say, into place, and snap back into the normal dialogue between the executive and Congress in the late 19th century. So much so that you actually have presidents like Ulysses S. Grant is a very good example of this. Garfield less so, but also an example of people who had views and had principles that they might have wanted to have a larger understanding of executive power, but felt very constrained by the constitutional system. So I think
I was just going to say, so thinking about the 20th century, coming to the 20th century, it's interesting to me when you say that, constrained thinking, that seems to be evidence for that in the fact that when America got into military action, when we were in shooting wars, it was almost always Congress had already declared war. War of 1812 was the Mexican-American War. The Civil War is declared an insurrection, at least. The Spanish-American War at the end of the 19th century. And then even World War I and World War II are declared wars. So that when the United States is engaging in military action, largely we have declared wars. But after World War II, it seems like we've had a lot of military engagement without any declarations of war.
Yes.
What has changed?
Yes. And that's a great question. It's the big thing that changed is that as you're watching the movement of the United States from the early 20th century to the mid 20th century, you see a phenomenal amount of change domestically, but also a phenomenal amount of change internationally. Most particularly, you see the European empires fall apart. And you see the rise of the of Russia in a communist form, and an extremely powerful and expansive. Sorry, that's the word. Is you know, you can see that communism not only wants to like take over all of the Russian Federation or what is now the Russian Federation, but move beyond its borders, move into all of Asia, take over all of Asia, and as best as possible, take over much of Eastern Europe. And as a consequence of this, the United States is then seeing an enemy that is no longer a state, but an enemy that is ideological. And that change from a state entity where you could say, okay, well, we have a return address. We can go and we can send our men to this place and they can fight with their men. And, you know, these things can be worked out the way that military conflicts have been worked out for millennia. When an idea like communism is combating an idea like liberal democracy, both are saying in a meaningful sense, we are the meta narrative. We are the best and final form of government. And unfortunately, as a consequence, coexistence doesn't seem possible to either one. So during the Cold War, what we see is presidents really taking much more of a step forward, and then Congress, rather than taking again their normal constitutional role, is that they are saying, because this enemy is so different and because it's ubiquitous, not only outside of our country, but potentially as well inside our country, we need the president to have a nimbleness and an ability to kind of react very quickly and effectively, not only to the ideological threat that comes from communism, but also the very, very real threat of worlds. Domination and the world being ended by nuclear weapons. And so that sort of twin threat was very, very difficult to combat. And that's why you have Congress ceding its power to the president and presidents very happily accepting that power.
So how do we see that? I'm thinking of two conflicts in particular after World War II, right? The Korean War,
yes,
and the Vietnam War, right? Both of which involved hundreds of thousands of American troops in shooting wars, neither won a declared war by Congress. How does that happen?
Yes. So in both instances, if you'll give me like a minute on the Korean War, because it's such an interesting and problematic case. And it's the first one, because what we see, having talked about Polk and saying, you know, this was the Constitution breaking down a little bit, but, you know, it snaps back into place. So the Korean War is an example of the Constitution breaking and then never snapping back into place. And also it demonstrates the problem of presidential decision making without any kind of real deliberative process, right? Part of what Congress is bringing into the table is a deliberative process to say, like, have you really thought this through, Mr. President? Like, do you know what you're doing? So in the case of Korea, what we have is three very, very big events happening very, very quickly to Harry Truman, who wasn't who wasn't a foreign policy leader prior to becoming the vice president, and then was very much thrown into world events once he became president after FDR. So the first is that the communists in Russia developed nuclear weapons. And this was in March or April of 1950. Next you have, this is sort of comical, but the Russian ambassador to the UN decided that he should walk out because the Americans, the French, and the British refused to see the new communist leader of China. And so the Russian ambassador to the UN Security Council said, if I walk out, they can't do anything. And the Americans, Europeans, and the Chinese just said, we're just going to keep doing stuff. And then finally, you had what's called NSC 68. And this is a report from the intelligence community at the time saying the only thing that we can do to really combat the Russians is to use force. And the only thing they'll respond to is the use of force. So you have those three things happening at once. And then you have the North Koreans invading the South Koreans. And Truman has the opportunity then to get a UN Security Council resolution that says we're going to have what is, let's say, politely deemed a police action, what is in actuality a war. And so you're correct to say we didn't have any constitutional conversation domestically where Congress said, okay, well, we will decide, we will give you permission, Mr. President, to start a war. This is what you can do. This is the, you know, weaponry and the amount of money that we'll give you to prosecute that war, which is what they've done in all their declarations. Instead, however, they implicitly give their permission by continuing to fund the Korean War without ever actually having, again, a deliberation about the merits of the war or a deliberation about passing a declaration domestically.
So Truman never went to Congress and said, I call on you to declare war on North Korea. He just sent troops and Congress funded it.
Yes. And he made the claim again. It was a novel claim at the time, but it's one that presidents since then have relied on. He made the claim that the UN Security Council supported it. And the United States, as the main founder and the most important member of the UN Security Council and the UN in general, had to uphold the UN Security Council resolution by going to war in Korea, but, you know, police action, to engage in a police action in Korea.
Before we continue with our discussion, I'd like to let you know about an outstanding set of programs that Ashbrook sponsors for high school students, the Ashbrook Academy.
Do you know any students with an interest in American history, politics, economics, and literature? Do they enjoy being academically challenged and the thrill of engaging with different ideas and viewpoints? Hi, I'm Sabrina Maristella, Student Programs Coordinator here at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Academy is a series of summer courses for rising high school juniors and seniors. Held in person at Ashland University, the Academy immerses you in the American story like you've never been before. Since 2015, our approach has taken history out of textbooks and into students' lives with historical documents and conversations about those documents. If you are a rising high school junior or senior, or if you know someone who is, we invite you to learn more about our courses and apply today at ashbrookacademy.org.
So do we see that same kind of argument in Vietnam? Lyndon Baines Johnson does not go to Congress, right, to request a declaration of war. But there is this thing, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. And so Congress seems to be involved somehow in maybe a way that's different from the Korean War. Tell us about the Vietnam War and the president's war powers.
Yes, this was a much more unilateral action on the part of the United States. So the Korean War, you can make a case that like there was international deliberation insofar as many, many partners of the U.S. also went into Korea and also participated in that war. So even Canadians, for example, right? So if the Canadians are involved, you're kind of like, okay, how bad could it be? It was very, very bad. It was a very, very brutal war. But I just mean that generally they're very diplomatic people. So conversely, with the Vietnam War, you see the United States just going in. And as you mentioned, there's the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. And essentially what this resolution says is nothing. And that's editorializing on my part. But Congress wanted to express that they understood that there was some kind of problem in Vietnam, right, at the time, and that the United States was, as a partner, kind of doing something to help partners over there. And so it was all this kind of language that doesn't perfectly say, again, you know, who you're fighting, how you're fighting them, when you have to stop, what will happen when you stop, which is what you get in declarations of war. And so this authorization was just kind of, you know, broad strokes. We say that the president should be helping in some kind of way. If he uses the military, that is permissible. But he is going to decide what is used and how it is justified. So again, this is Congress somewhat involving itself by taking a backseat and saying, you decide, Mr. President, you know what's best, which again is not constitutionally what their role is supposed to be. They are supposed to be sitting there saying, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? Who are we doing it against? And, you know, how will it end?
Yeah, I was going to ask that. During the Vietnam War or right after, is there... does Congress ever push back against presidents like Lyndon Johnson?
In an unsatisfying way, or I found it very unsatisfying. So you have the War Powers Resolution, and that was in 1974. It might have been off by a year. That might be 1973. And this is against Nixon. And this is essentially saying that presidents do not have the power that since FDR they have been asserting they have. And so Congress is essentially saying, you know, this is what the Constitution says. And if you look at the War Powers Resolution, much like the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, you're kind of like, all right, I see what you're doing, but like, you're doing it wrong. And so in the War Powers Resolution, they say, you know, you're only allowed to have the military involved in a few criteria, in a few cases, all of which are laid out in the Constitution, right? If there's an invasion, right, this isn't in the Constitution, but it's very, very broadly accepted, even amongst the founders. Even Madison said, you know, we have to have a way for a president to act constitutionally if there's an invasion. And then otherwise, if there's a declaration or an authorization, the president can act. But then, foolishly, they say, if the president does initiate military operations, he can do so for 60 days, and then he has 30 more days to withdraw the troops. And so you think to yourself, well, wait a second, you just laid out that he can't do this, that he can never do this. So how is it that you're saying simultaneously that if he does do it, then, you know, these are the restrictions? And essentially what we then have is a president or presidents who have permission to a meaningful extent based on the War Powers Resolution to engage in what I like to call Top Gun wars, right? So they're flyover wars, you know, we're just bombing a place from a plane so American military members are safe. They're never really in harm's way. That's not technically true, but you know, it's that term, we don't put boots on the ground. And so presidents since that time, since the 70s, have essentially said, you know, we have that power to do something that's not quite allowable, but they open this door for us to make it seem allowable. And since that time, Congress has failed to put the genie back in the bottle.
So what about times since then, since Vietnam, where in fact America has had boots on the ground, engaging in a war, still never declared wars? I'm thinking of Operation Desert Storm in 1990 with George H.W. Bush, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 with George W. Bush, the military action in Afghanistan in response to 9/11 in 2001. Certainly, those have involved boots on the ground. How is it that presidents were able to initiate that military action without Congress declaring war?
There's three different possibilities. So the first is domestically sanctioned, which is authorizations for the use of military force. It's a very annoying term because you say AUMF, and people are like, what are you talking about? Like, what's this acronym? You know, and like, what does it have to do with like LOL or like IRL or something like that? But it's actually an authorization. And so these are typically, so since the Gulf of Tonkin, so we've had the Gulf of Tonkin, then we had the 1991 authorization for Desert Storm, as you mentioned. And then we have a 2001 and a 2002 AUMF, so all authorizations. In all these cases, you can make the claim that there is congressional authorization, right? The difficulty with them, all four of them, right, the Vietnam, first Gulf War, second Gulf War, and the war in Afghanistan, is that they all have this hedging language, and it's very, very vague as to what it is the president can or cannot do. And
so I'm clear, Congress in those four situations has said to the president, we authorize you to use military force, but we are not declaring war.
Yes. Yes. And so they're authorizing military force, but they aren't even quite going that far. What they are often doing is saying, we authorize the president to have the power to decide if we are going to have any military action. And so they don't even want to make the decision as to whether or not there will be military action. They want to give the president nearly total control over the power to decide if there's going to be military action.
So what about then, and obviously presidents have used that, but you do hear occasionally calls in Congress now and even recently to say, for example, the military action that we took in Syria and the Obama administration undertook that, even the Trump administration to some degree. And there were some members of Congress, including people in each president's own party, who said, wait a minute, when we passed those authorizations for use of military force way back 20 years ago, we did not envision bombing in Syria. That's not covered by this. So we need to get rid of this, and you don't have authorization to do it, or you need to come to us to get some kind of another authorization or another, even a declaration of war, because otherwise you're just conducting military action without permission from Congress. Has that had any traction or success in Congress?
So the first time that there was some sort of conversation around it was in 2013 when Obama, and again, I'm not at all sort of saying something bad about Obama that I wouldn't say about every other president. They're all kind of like playing pretty fast and loose with constitutional structures. But Obama decided in 2013, in August, that he had just recalled that he was the leader of the oldest constitutional democracy. And so he was asking Congress to give him an authorization to go and bomb Syria. And then the next year, this is why it's comical, and I apologize for anyone who doesn't have a dark sense of humor. But the next year, he forgot, I guess, that he was the leader of a constitutional democracy, because he just started bombing Syria and started bombing Iraq because ISIS had shown up. And so everyone in the U.S. was like, we don't need congressional authorization, just keep us safe. And so in both of those instances, you had a kind of moment where, like, let's say Congress kind of entertained the possibility of passing a new authorization or sunsetting the old authorizations from the early days of the war on terror, but they never really got any traction. During the Trump administration, there was a little bit more talk about potentially sunsetting the congressional authorizations, but this didn't get very far either. And it was 2001 when you had a concerted effort from, now I'm going to forget who three was involved. So it was Bernie Sanders, Mike Lee, and then Chris Murphy were the three who were the main creators of a great authorization that, you know, didn't
very
solve
different, by the way, very different political parties and very different political philosophies in many ways.
Yes, yes. Very good. Very good.
What right? did they agree on?
They agreed that there had to be a sunsetting of the AUMFs and then a new kind of authorization from Congress. So that, again, there was some sort of like nimbleness for the president to act in like a very scary situation when it came to especially terrorism and reacting to terrorism. But there was constraint and there was congressional oversight and there was congressional deliberation that was going to hold the president accountable. So this was like a pretty good moment when there was a possibility they might get that passed. There was a lot of people drawn in to try and help with this. And it died. It just couldn't get off the ground. It couldn't get enough traction for whatever reason. And then there have been more recently more limited efforts to try. And this is a little bit complicated, but as we know, there's been a recent bombing from the U.S. to the Houthis or against the Houthis in Yemen. And the Houthis are connected to the Saudis, Saudi Arabia. And there have been some concerted efforts to try and get the U.S. funding for Saudi Arabia to no longer fund the Yemeni government that are fighting the Houthis, which I know is a bouncing ball, and I apologize for that. But those are the two things that have attempted to get traction. So a broad, really big authorization that would cover everything, and then a very limited authorization that would say America cannot fund the civil war in Yemen, then we have to constrain the amount of weaponry that's getting into Yemen and inflaming this civil war that continues to this day.
So we are right now sort of stuck, it sounds like, in kind of constitutional limbo. We've got presidents like President Biden saying, I have the unconstrained authority to use military force as necessary around the world to protect the United States. You've got some members of Congress saying, no, you need our permission or at least our oversight. And then it sounds like you have a lot of people kind of in the middle, unwilling to make a decision.
Yeah, that's where I would place it, is that we have this, as you put it, I think nicely, a constitutional limbo, the sense that, you know, Congress doesn't have the wherewithal, the interest for a variety of reasons to really stand up and say, we want to reassert our authority in this realm and we want to claw back some of our powers from the executive branch. Similarly, you have executive branch after executive branch after executive branch continuing to say that they have all of these powers either within Article 2, right? That's just housed somehow magically, that developed somehow over time in Article 2. And since FDR, or alternatively, you have presidents who say, well, we have all the authorization we need because we have the war on terror authorizations from 2001 and 2002, right? And those are so broad that like it is legitimate for them to claim it. It should be that Congress calls them on it, but they don't.
So I'm always reluctant to ask political scientists to end by making a prediction, but sure. Predict for us. Where do you think the issue of presidents and war powers, what does it look like going forward in the next decade?
Yeah.
Will it matter who is president, or do you think all presidents, no matter what party they are going to assert this power? And do you think Congress is still going to go along with it? Or do you think we'll see pushback? What do you predict?
It's a very important question. And you're right to say that, you know, asking for predictions is always problematic. And so what I'll say is, you know, my joke is in 2016, when Trump got elected, all political scientists got a letter saying, stop making predictions. You guys are clearly bad at it. You did a bad job here. We all knew it after the fact. But like at the time, you know, we all predicted it wrong. So having said, you know, I was entirely incorrect when it came to Trump being able to become president. Just looking at the facts and what I had thought was, you know, 10 solid years of presidential scholarship. But I digress. The point is that with that caveat, I would say it does really depend on the personality. One of the things I try and emphasize in the book, for better and worse, is that, and I meant to say better and worse there, for better and worse, we have to rely a lot on the personality of the president because there are so few constraints on presidential power and so few constraints on unilateralism. And so when we see a president like Trump, who is inclined to exercise power very broadly and without some sort of ideological consistency that you can say, okay, well, I can predict how he's going to do one thing or another. In contrast, if you look at, say, President Biden, who kind of came into office seeming as if he was inclined to be restrained. So he had a little bit, I would say, of like a Jimmy Carter vibe, right? And I don't mean that negatively. I mean that in the sense that Jimmy Carter came in after Watergate and at a time when people really wanted like a moral refreshing. So I had kind of thought Biden might be the one who really did say, okay, we need Congress to reassert itself, right? He had spent a lot of time in the legislature as well. And that hasn't really happened. So like possibly we might see that in his second term because that really will be his swan song. That really will be the end of his presidency and his time in public office. So seeing him do something that would rebalance the constitutional system, I think would be perhaps maybe just a dream of mine. And so I'm not too hopeful that I could see that, but that's the kind of thing I could see someone like a Biden doing. Otherwise, the events you have to wonder about are the catalytic events. So another moment like a pandemic, another kind of thing of that size and change. If we had had Hillary Clinton in office rather than Donald Trump, I think you would have seen the presidency expand very dramatically under her. And you would have seen the powers of the state shrink very dramatically under her. And so I think if we have something like that, if we have a real emergency under another president in the next decade, so we might see this catalytic event where we see presidential power dramatically expand, right, beyond what we've even seen now. Or we might see that be the shock that really gets Congress back together as a branch and has them reassert their ambition to counteract the ambition in the executive branch and reassert their interests as a branch against the presidency.
Well, it will be fascinating to see that, to watch that play out. Obviously, it's such an incredibly important debate for America, for our future, for our involvement in the world, and for our constitutional order. Sarah, thanks for taking the time to help us understand the roots of it and what we need to be looking for. Again, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's been wonderful chatting with you as usual, and I look forward to, you know, working with you in the future.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.